Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in for quite a ride. We're heading back to the 17th century in Britain.
That's 1603 to 1714, the whole Stuart era.
Yeah, and it's got everything, doesn't it? Civil War, a king losing his head, republics, revolutions. It's dramatic stuff.
It really is. Historians often call it the long 17th century. And look, if you think you know the basic story, you know, king versus parliament inevitably leading to democracy, well, you might need to adjust your thinking a bit after this. We're diving deep into John Morrill's really important work, Stuart Britain.
Right. So our mission today is to get into Morrill's powerful revisionist take on things.
Exactly. He fundamentally challenges that old traditional story. He argues the birth of the modern British state wasn't neat or inevitable at all.
It was messier.
Much messier, far more accidental, and crucially, absolutely steeped in religious conflict, more than we usually think.
And that's why it matters now, right? Because that chaotic period is where so many of the political ideas and institutions we still grapple with came from.
Precisely. Parliamentary supremacy, constitutional monarchy, even things like the Bank of England, their roots are in this messy century. Morrill gives us a way to understand the surprising and complex truth behind how they actually got started.
Okay, so before we dive into the arguments, tell us about the man himself, John Morrill. He's the key voice for this revisionist perspective.
He absolutely is. I mean, he's a giant in the field, emeritus professor at Cambridge, fellow of the British Academy, definitely a leading figure when it comes to rethinking the English Civil War.
Okay, revisionist. That sounds academic. For those of us who maybe didn't major in history, what does that actually mean? Why does he reject that older Whig view you mentioned?
That's a really good question. So the old Whig view, basically, it saw history as a straight line.
Like progress.
Exactly. Progress marching inevitably towards a specific goal in this case. Modern liberty, parliament winning, democracy arriving, kind of a predetermined endpoint.
Right.
The revisionists, like Morrill, stepped back and said, hang on, that's looking backwards with modern eyes. They argued that's not how people at the time saw it or experienced it.
So history doesn't just naturally move towards the ending we like.
Pretty much. And Morrill's really distinctive angle comes from his method. He pioneered what's called a bottom-up approach.
Meaning not just kings and queens.
Right. He didn't just focus on the high politics in London, the court, the big parliamentary debates. He looked elsewhere.
So bottom-up, is that about ordinary people? Or something specific, like local towns?
It's quite specific, actually.
Oh.
His early work, like The Revolt of the Provinces, was groundbreaking because it showed that for many, maybe most people back then, their primary loyalty wasn't to the king or parliament as abstract ideas.
It was more local.
Much more local. Their county community, their region, their neighbors, their local gentry, that was the focus. And this insight allowed him to argue that most people were actually very reluctant to get involved in the Civil War.
They weren't eager revolutionaries.
Not at all. They were often pushed into it by local issues, fear of disorder spreading to their county, things like that. Not necessarily grand ideology.
And you mentioned religion is key for him.
Absolutely central. Morrill insists you just cannot understand the 17th century, its politics, its wars, its identity, without grasping how deeply religious people were. For him, religion wasn't just a cover for political or economic motives.
He was the main driver.
Yes. He argues it was the core organizing principle, the primary thing that motivated people to act, to choose sides, even to die.
Okay, so let's get to the book's main argument. If this century of turmoil wasn't some inevitable march to democracy, what did cause the English Civil War and everything that followed, according to Morrill?
Morrill's central thesis is that it was all a contingent crisis, not a planned revolution, not a simple class struggle.
Contingent meaning it didn't have to happen.
Exactly. It was more like a perfect storm, a convergence of factors that together led to collapse. He points to three main ingredients.
Okay, what are they?
One, the political failures and, frankly, the inflexibility of King Charles I, and he just couldn't compromise effectively. Two, deep, irreconcilable religious divisions, not just between Catholic and Protestant, but within Protestantism itself. Puritans versus the more high church types. And three, this massive structural problem of trying to govern three distinct, often hostile kingdoms, England, Scotland, and Ireland all at once.
That's the British problem you hear about, so you can't just look at England in isolation.
Absolutely not. Ignoring Scotland and Ireland means you fundamentally misunderstand why the whole thing blew up. Scotland was fiercely Presbyterian, England was Anglican but deeply divided, Ireland had its own complex mix of Catholics and Protestant settlers.
Trying to force one religious model on all three
was a recipe for disaster. And this leads to Morrill's really striking conclusion. The English Civil War, he argues, was less the first modern revolution.
And more.
More like the last of Europe's great wars of religion.
Wow. That really reframes it. But what about the things older historians emphasized? Like economic issues, conflicts between nobles and merchants. Do those just disappear?
Not disappear, no. Morrill acknowledges those tensions existed, but he'd argue they were almost always expressed through and driven by religious language and anxieties.
So religion was the lens people used to understand their grievances.
Precisely. For the people living through it, faith usually trumped economics or class as the primary motivator. The big takeaway is that the war resulted from a systemic failure, a breakdown of trust and governance that almost nobody wanted or predicted.
Okay, let's trace that breakdown. Can we walk through the timeline a bit? Starting before the war, say 1603 to 1640.
Sure. The problems really start simmering under James I, who ruled from 1603 to 1625. He inherits this multiple monarchy issue straight away.
He was James VI of Scotland before becoming James I of England.
Right, and while he liked being called Rex Pacificus, the peaceful king, he didn't really solve the underlying structural issues. There was a constant shortage of money for the crown, Parliament was getting more assertive, and the religious scene was fractured.
He tried a middle way in the Church of England.
He did, but it ended up pleasing almost no one. The really zealous Protestants, the Puritans, felt he didn't go far enough in reforming the church. And the other side, the emerging Arminian faction that liked more ceremony, felt he didn't go far enough their way.
So unresolved problems festering. Not outright tyranny yet, but setting the stage.
Exactly. The seeds were sown. Then comes his son, Charles I, from 1625. And Morrill's portrayal is fascinating. He sees Charles as genuinely devout, principled even, but fatally flawed, politically rigid, deeply untrustworthy in negotiations, and just, well, inept at managing Parliament and people.
And that rigidity led to the personal rule.
Yes. After clashes with Parliament early on, Charles decided to rule without calling one for 11 years, from 1629 to 1640.
How did he pay for things?
Controversial methods. Things like reviving old feudal dues and, most famously, extending ship money, a tax traditionally only levied on coastal counties, for naval defense to the entire country. That caused resentment.
But Morrill says taxes weren't the main thing that alienated people.
No. The real catalyst, according to Morrill, was religion. Specifically, the policies pushed by Charles's Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud.
Okay, let's pause here because you said this is crucial for Morrill. Laud's Arminianism. What did that involve, and why did it freak out the Puritans so much?
Right. Arminianism, in Laud's version, stressed things the Puritans hated. More ceremony, more ritual, enhancing the beauty of holiness. Think decorated churches, priests wearing vestments, moving the communion table to the east end like an altar, using altar rails.
And the Puritans saw this as?
As popery. As sliding back towards Roman Catholicism, which they saw as idolatrous, superstitious, and politically linked to tyranny and absolutism on the continent, it wasn't just about church decoration, it was about the soul of the nation and the future of Protestantism.
So this religious policy was deeply, deeply alarming to a very powerful segment of the political nation.
Far more alarming and alienating than ship money ever was. It felt like a fundamental betrayal.
Okay, so James I leaves festering problems. Charles I adds rigidity and religious policies that terrify many. It feels like a powder keg. What lit the fuse in the late 1630s?
And here's where Morrill's British problem argument really kicks in. The spark didn't come from England.
It came from
Scotland. Charles and Laud tried to impose a version of the English prayer book on the fiercely Presbyterian Scots in 1637.
How did that go down?
Disastrously. It led to the Scottish Prayer Book Rebellion. The Scots raised an army, fought Charles's forces, and effectively bankrupted him.
And that's why he had to call the English Parliament in 1640. He needed money.
Exactly. He was broke and needed Parliament to grant funds to fight the Scots. But that Parliament, the Long Parliament, wasn't in a cooperative mood. They used the king's weakness to start dismantling his government and impeaching his ministers, like Laud.
But even then, war wasn't certain. What was the point of no return?
Morrill points very clearly to the Irish uprising in late 1641.
What happened there?
Native Irish Catholics rose up against the Protestant settlers and English administration. There were brutal massacres, and the reports reaching England, often wildly exaggerated, caused absolute panic.
People feared a Catholic invasion.
Yes, and they knew a large army was needed immediately to crush the Irish rebellion. But here's the absolute deadlock, the kicker. Neither the king nor Parliament trusted the other side to command that army.
Because whoever controlled the army could potentially use it against their domestic rivals.
Precisely. That total collapse of trust over who controls the military force needed for Ireland, that, for moral, is what made the English Civil War unavoidable.
And when the war finally breaks out in 1642, you mentioned moral stresses, people were reluctant fighters?
Very much so. It wasn't like everyone immediately rushed to join up based on pure ideology.
So why did people choose sides?
Complex reasons. Often it was about local loyalties, following the local landowner, or defending their county from the other side's troops and the chaos they brought. Protecting hearth and home was a huge motivator.
So the war was almost imposed on ordinary people by this breakdown at the top.
That's a good way to put it. And this breakdown, this chaos, eventually led to the army itself becoming radicalized, especially the new model army, Cromwell's force.
They felt Parliament wasn't radical enough or wasn't rewarding them properly.
Both. They felt betrayed by politicians trying to disband them without settling arrears of pay or guaranteeing indemnity. This led directly to the army intervening in politics, purging Parliament, and, well, the ultimate act.
The execution of Charles I in 1649.
An absolutely shocking, unprecedented event. If morals right that most people dreaded the war in the first place, you can imagine the horror and trauma that regicide caused across the country.
It must have been profound. And it made Charles a martyr figure for many, didn't it?
Instantly and enduringly. So after the execution, England becomes a republic, the Commonwealth. And Oliver Cromwell emerges as the dominant figure. How does Morrill see him?
Well, he acknowledges Cromwell's military genius, absolutely, and his sincere, if sometimes severe, religious conviction.
But politically.
A political failure. That's Morrill's assessment. Cromwell tried various constitutional setups, the Commonwealth, then the Protectorate, with himself as Lord Protector. But none of them stuck.
None of them achieved real stability or broad legitimacy. They were ultimately propped up by the power of the army. There was no widespread popular enthusiasm for republican rule.
So this whole decade or so without a king, it didn't really work out.
It didn't. And Morrill argues this failure, combined with a deep war weariness across all three kingdoms, is what made the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 not just possible, but almost inevitable. People were exhausted.
Okay, so Charles II, son of the executed king, comes back in 1660. Big celebrations, right?
Huge celebrations, widespread relief. But the political settlement that followed, the restoration settlement, wasn't exactly about healing wounds.
Oh, how so?
It was quite vengeful, actually, especially towards the religious groups who'd been on the parliamentarian side, particularly the Puritans, or dissenters, as they were increasingly called.
How do they do?
A series of laws known as the Clarendon Code were passed. These basically barred dissenters from holding public office, from attending universities, even from having their ministers preach near towns. It was harsh persecution.
So it didn't bring unity?
Quite the opposite. It created deep, lasting divisions in English society and politics. And these divisions fueled the rise of the first real political parties, the Whigs and Tories, during the next big crisis.
Which was?
The exclusion crisis in the late 1670s and early 1680s. Charles II had no legitimate children, and his heir was his younger brother, James.
And James was?
Openly Catholic, which terrified many Protestants who remembered the religious wars and feared Catholicism meant absolutism. The Whigs in Parliament tried desperately to pass laws to exclude James from the throne.
Did they succeed?
No, Charles II blocked them. But the whole crisis showed how deep the fear of Catholicism still ran. And it set the stage for the next disaster when James actually did become king.
James II. His reign was short, wasn't it?
Very short and utterly catastrophic, 1685 to 1688. James was zealous, politically inept, and seemed determined to promote Catholicism and rule absolutely, ignoring laws and conventions.
He managed to alienate pretty much everyone.
Just about everyone, including the Tories who had previously supported hereditary right. His actions seemed to confirm everyone's worst fears.
Which led to the Glorious Revolution.
Exactly. A group of leading nobles and churchmen basically invited William of Orange, the Protestant ruler of the Netherlands, who was married to James II's Protestant daughter, Mary, to invade and save England from popery and tyranny.
And Morrill's take on this. Is it glory?
He calls it, quite pointedly, an aristocratic coup d'etat.
A coup, not a popular revolution for liberty.
Morrill argues it was fundamentally a conservative move by the ruling elite, the aristocracy, the gentry, the church leaders, to protect their established order.
Protect the Anglican Church and their property rights.
Precisely. From a king they saw as dangerously unstable and undermining the foundations of their power. It wasn't primarily about abstract rights for all, it was about preserving the existing system from a Catholic threat.
So the outcome wasn't necessarily intended to be revolutionary, but it had huge consequences.
Huge. The revolution settlement that followed included the Bill of Rights in 1689, which formally limited the monarch's power and asserted Parliament's rights. There was also a Toleration Act, granting limited freedom of worship to Protestant dissenters, though not Catholics.
And alongside this political settlement, there was another big development.
Yes, driven by the almost constant warfare of the late 17th century, especially against Louis XIV's France, Britain developed what historians call the fiscal military state, a state incredibly effective at raising money through parliamentary taxation, creating a national debt, founding the Bank of England in 1694 specifically to fund large armies and navies. This financial power became crucial to Britain's rise.
And the century's conflicts finally wound down with one last major structural change.
The Act of Union with Scotland in 1707. This formally merged the kingdoms of England and Scotland into Great Britain, creating a single parliament. It didn't solve all the problems, but it did finally address that core multiple monarchy issue that had plagued the Stuarts from the start.
Okay, we've run through the tumultuous timeline. Let's pull back and really crystallize the main themes Morrill wants us to grasp from all this. The first one, we've hit it a few times, but it's clearly number one, the primacy of religion.
Absolutely. It's the bedrock. Morrill insists you have to take the religious beliefs and motivations of the people seriously. They weren't just window dressing for politics or economics.
The major crises were fundamentally religious crises.
At their core, yes. And the reflection for us, maybe, is that we can't just impose our modern, often secular, viewpoints onto the past. Understanding deep-seated belief systems, whether religious or ideological, is crucial to understanding why people act the way they do.
Okay, theme two. The British problem, three kingdoms.
Right. The reminder that the upheavals of the 1640s weren't just an English civil war. It was a collapse of the entire Stuart state structure across England, Scotland, and Ireland. Events in one kingdom constantly spilled over and ignited problems in the others.
So the lesson is to think bigger than just national borders sometimes, to see the interconnectedness.
Exactly. It encourages a more integrated, less Anglo-centric view of history.
Theme three comes from that bottom-up perspective. Localism and the unwanted war.
Yeah, the idea that most ordinary people were dragged into these conflicts reluctantly. Their main concern was often protecting their own locality, their county community, from disorder and marauding soldiers.
So ideology might be driving the leaders, but for many on the ground,
it's about survival, security, protecting what's familiar. It reminds us that even during huge historical shifts, everyday concerns and local loyalties remain incredibly powerful.
And the final theme, running underneath all the chaos, the rise of the modern state.
Kind of ironically, isn't it? All this conflict, instability, and failure actually forced innovation. The constant need to raise vast sums of money for war led, step by painful step, to the creation of this incredibly powerful fiscal military state.
The Bank of England, national debt, efficient taxation.
All born out of the desperate necessities of war. So stability and state power weren't achieved through peaceful planning, but hammered out in the forge of conflict.
Morrill really has some powerful ways of summing up these big ideas. Let's share a few of those key Morrillisms, those conceptual takeaways that really stick.
Good idea. They capture his revisionist stance so well.
Okay, first up, perhaps the most famous. The English Civil War was the last of Europe's great wars of religion, not the first modern revolution.
Boom! Right there, it flips the whole narrative, puts faith front and center, not politics or class in the modern sense.
Second key idea, the collapse of the Stuart state was a British, not just an English, event. The triggers were pulled in Edinburgh and Dublin.
Again, challenges that narrow England-focused view. You have to look at all three kingdoms.
Third one is quite insightful about how change happens. Religious diversity was achieved not through the triumph of toleration, but through the failure of uniformity.
I love that one. It suggests that pluralism wasn't necessarily born out of high-minded ideals about tolerance winning the day.
It was more pragmatic.
Yeah, more like everyone got exhausted trying to force their version of religion on everyone else, and they eventually, grudgingly, had to settle for living side by side. Diversity through failure, not design.
And a final one, looking at the end result. By 1714, Britain had accidentally created the most successful political system in Europe, not through superior wisdom, but through superior flexibility.
That emphasizes adaptability. The system that emerged wasn't perfect, it wasn't planned, but it proved remarkably resilient and adaptable because it had been forged through so much trial and error, mostly error.
These insights aren't just for historians, are they? Morals analysis seems to offer some really practical lessons for today.
Absolutely. The first one that jumps out is about the dangers of ideological rigidity.
Charles I being the prime example.
The absolute case study. His conviction in his own divine right, his inability or refusal to genuinely compromise, led directly to disaster, war, defeat, execution. It's a stark warning for any leader, isn't it? Especially in diverse societies. Inflexibility can be fatal.
Yeah. Lesson two feels incredibly relevant right now. The fragility of political trust.
Oh, hugely. The slide into the Civil War was just a complete meltdown of trust between king and parliament and among different factions.
Each side assumed the worst of the other.
Constantly. Every action was interpreted in the most negative light possible. It created this spiral of paranoia, suspicion, and escalation. You see echoes of that in modern political polarization, I think. Rebuilding institutional trust is so vital, and moral shows how quickly it can vanish.
And a third takeaway is about how we analyze problems, understanding complex causation.
Right. Moral forces us to reject simple, single-cause explanations. The Stuart crisis wasn't just Charles III's fault, or just about religion, or just economics.
Like everything tangled together.
Exactly. A messy confluence of religious anxiety, long-term structural weaknesses in the state, short-term political blunders, personality clashes, economic strains, the list goes on. That skill, teasing out multiple interacting causes, is essential for tackling complex problems today, whether it's climate change or geopolitical conflict.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into morals work, what's the one thing that really stood out for you, perhaps surprised you?
You know, for me, it really was the sheer accidental nature of the system that emerged. We tend to look back at things like parliamentary sovereignty or constitutional monarchy as if they were the intended destination all along.
The end point of that Whig progress narrative.
Right. But moral makes such a compelling case that it was anything but planned. It was forged in failure. It was the failure of Charles I's absolutism, the failure of the Republic to find stability, even the failures and vindictiveness of the Restoration. All these missteps and crises forced adaptation and compromise, leading almost stumbled into a system that proved surprisingly durable.
That's a fantastic point. The success came through the failures. My final takeaway is similar, maybe focusing on the power of belief. Moral just constantly brings you back to how profoundly deep-seated belief systems, whether we call them religion or ideology, shape political reality.
They're not trivial.
Not at all. And his work is a powerful reminder that stability in any diverse state seems to rely not on finding the one perfect system, but on constant negotiation, compromise, and crucially, leaders who are adaptable rather than rigid. It really changes how you see the triumph of the British system. Less a genius plan, more a messy, chaotic, but ultimately successful evolution born from crisis.
Well said. A truly fascinating and challenging perspective on a pivotal century.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.